I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. On today's show, Sarah Perry on her latest novel, Enlightenment. Sarah Perry is the internationally best-selling author of the novels Melmoth, The Essex Serpent, and After Me Comes the Flood, and the non-fiction book Essex Girls. She is a winner of the Waterstones Book of the Year Award and has been nominated for the Women's Prize, the Folio Prize, and the Costa Novel Award. And she is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and has a PhD in creative writing. And today we're here to talk about Sarah's latest novel, which is Enlightenment. Sarah, welcome back to Little Atoms.
Thank you for having me back.
Tell us then, first of all, how you would describe this novel.
I would say that it is a novel, again, about the conversation between faith and reason and about the pursuit of love and about astronomy and the nature of time, which sounds like a rather grand setup for a story.
So before we talk about any of the characters, I want to talk to you about Essex for a bit for a couple of reasons. First of all, because we never talked about Essex Girls, so I have a chance to get a little bit about that in. But mainly, I want to talk about your Essex, because this novel is set in a fictional town in Essex called Oldley, which just happens to be up the road. The characters take a trip at one point in the novel to another village called Old Winter, which is, of course, the village that the Essex Serpent was set in.
Yeah.
And serpents are mentioned in the novel, and the traitor's oak, a tree in Old Winter, is mentioned. So I want to talk about your fictional Essex and, I guess, how those two novels are related, if at all, apart from the theme, which you've already...
So I don't live in Essex. I was born and brought up there. And Essex is kind of like the material of my imagination. So writing about Essex doesn't feel to me like a conscious choice to locate a novel in that county particularly. It's more the case that my imaginative world is comprised absolutely of East Anglia and specifically of Essex. So if you were to say to me, imagine a cottage in a field, I would see very specifically a gently sloping, you know, wheat field or oilseed rape field like you get in Essex. And the cottage would be painted pink like the traditional Essex cottages. And the trees would be oaks, not pines. There would be hedgerows, not dry stone walls. And there wouldn't be red kites. There'd be kestrels. So Essex as the location for my books is kind of like matter, right? It's sort of what I've got. And so when I began to think about the setting for Enlightenment, a lot of which is drawn from my own upbringing in Essex, that was the material that I had. And then because I'm always partly existing in the imaginative spaces of previous novels, it just sort of made sense to me that it was almost set in the version of Essex, a kind of parallel Essex that the Essex Serpent was also set in. It felt both natural and like quite a nice little trick. If you see what I mean.
There's also something really powerful about, for anyone that's read The Essex Serpent, about the visit to Old Winter in this story, because things have changed.
Yes. Well, I'm very concerned, and this novel, Enlightenment in particular, is very concerned with the nature of time and the passage of time and the idea that It doesn't pass away from us unreturnable and irrecoverable, but rather we're living on a kind of palimpsest of times past, but also times to come in the future, all coexisting in this is kind of one space. So I think for Essex for me is almost like pinning down through layers of real time and fictional time, and all of it existing together. So the visit to Alderwinter could potentially be quite melancholy and quite sad, or it could be read as being a kind of reclaiming of that fictional past, that, you know, the old footsteps are still there and that Cora and Will are still walking out there. But yeah, the idea of time being persistent, fictional time and real time, is quite appealing to me.
So tell us something about Alderley, the town. What's it like?
I had this really interesting experience recently. I was born and brought up in Chelmsford, and I very rarely go back. My family no longer lives there, so I don't have much of a reason to go back. But I went back there recently for an appointment, and I was thunderstruck by the extent to which Alderley is mapped over Chelmsford, which is totally unconscious. So it's a small Essex town, essentially ordinary, but I suppose the premise for the book, and for all my books, is that nothing is ordinary, everything is extraordinary. And so there is a little strict Baptist chapel there, and behind the chapel there is a parkland where there's a very dilapidated manor house called Lowlands. And then there's the modern town with the offices of the Essex Chronicle, which is where my main character lives. And the characters kind of move between the chapel and Lowlands, this dilapidated house, and the town centre, where there's, you know, recognisable Essexy town centre things like a marketplace and a martyr's memorial and all of those kinds of things. And yeah, it was quite striking to me when I went back to Chelmsford, seeing the pub and the railway station and the railway arches. I thought, oh yeah, I know where they came from.
So the book is set over three time periods. It starts in 1997. There's a section in 2008 and then again in 2017. I want to talk about why 1997 in particular.
Well, one of the sort of main subjects of the book is astronomy and the movement of heavenly bodies and how they can offer a kind of mapping or parable for how we understand the motion of our own lives and relationships. And in 1997, there was a great comet, which, you know, people who are maybe 30 or older will remember, which is the great comet of our age, really. It's a huge comet that hung around for days and days and days, very visible in the sky. And so the novel begins as Hale Bopp is coming over Essex, and it offers a kind of useful encounter with the sublime for the characters.
The first character I want to talk about is Thomas Hart, who is the one that you've just alluded to, who works for the Essex Chronicle, the local newspaper. Tell us something about who Thomas is.
I'm really... I kind of laugh slightly when I describe him, because really he's sort of me, so, but transmuted into a completely different physical form. So when the novel begins, Thomas is 50 and he's a member of a strict Baptist chapel, but he leads a double life. So he's a gay man and he has an enormous fondness for the community and for the placidity of the strict Baptist chapel where he was born and brought up. But that chapel would teach him that his nature is a sin. And so he goes up to London, where he lives a kind of full life as a gay man. And then he comes back to the pew in Bethesda. And he actually is quite a sort of well-regarded writer, but nobody in Bethesda Chapel in Audley, this small town, has any inkling that he's quite a serious writer. All they know is that he writes a column for the Essex Chronicle. And one day the editor at the Essex Chronicle decides that he needs to go and write about Hale Bopp, this comet that's just turned up. And Thomas is very reluctant. He's got no interest in astronomy at all. And he goes out one day with his binoculars in a terrible temper and decides to look at the sky. And he falls in love with the moon. And over the course of the 20 years of the novel, his love for astronomy grows and grows and grows. And he ends up teaching himself about quantum mechanics and astrophysics, and really leaning on the study of physics and astronomy as a kind of proxy for his faith.
So tell us something about the Bethesda Chapel that he goes to, and particularly the Baptist sect, which is the strict and particular sect. Tell us something about who they are.
So There was a time in the 19th century when basically all Baptists were strict and particular Baptists. And what that means is strict communion, restricted communion. So you could only take communion if you were baptised as an adult, not as a child. And particular because they believed in the concept of particular redemption, which is the Calvinist principle that, you know, God has kind of chosen his people and Christ's death was particularly for them and not for anyone else. And then as modernity kind of came in, most Baptist churches just became general Baptists, but a few stayed stuck in the 19th century. And it's a real handful of churches. And when I say stuck in the 19th century, I mean that they used the King James Bible, never anything any later than 1611, sung Victorian hymns, really dressed in a way that was not quite Victorian, but definitely not particularly modern, and kind of shunned the modern world. And that's how I was brought up. So I quite often joke to people that I was born in 1850 because it's the most accurate description of the kind of upbringing that I had. So Thomas, as somebody who was raised in the strict Baptist church, has a kind of out of time feeling. He never feels completely at home in the modern world, which makes him kind of quite charming to people, but also, you know, constantly isolated and feeling out of place.
So he's contacted at the newspaper by James Bower, who's a curator at the local museum. Tell us something about who James is, what he wants from Thomas, and what effect this has on Thomas.
So I'm really keen on books having a mystery, right? So I don't feel like I should be forced to choose between writing literary fiction and you know, a novel of ideas and writing something that somebody wants to read. So I wanted to have a mystery. And James Bower is like the avatar of this mystery. So James has been looking after this house, Lowlands, that is falling into ruin. And while they've been renovating the house, they've found some papers underneath the floorboards with these very, very strange scribbled drawings. And James's theory is that these belong to a woman called Maria, who lived in the house 150 years before and vanished without a trace. And he wants people to be interested in this mystery. And he thinks that if the Essex Chronicle can write about it, then he will, you know, he'll have the funding and have the interest to be able to pursue this mystery. So he writes to Thomas and they meet. And the meeting is kind of catastrophic for Thomas because he's never had a love. He's had plenty of desire and plenty of sex, but he's denied himself a kind of flourishing, full erotic love out of, I guess, the shame of the church. And the interaction between him and James Bower, who's an extremely handsome man of about his own age, seems to him to be charged with a kind of sexual promise, and he falls in love. And it's really just a trick of the light, but this love powers him through the next 20 years of his life as he kind of seeks to unravel the mystery of Lowland's house and these peculiar papers, but also to try to come to terms with what do you do with your love when it isn't wanted.
Tell us something about Lowland's house.
I realised after I'd written it that it bears a very striking similarity to the slightly dilapidated house in my debut novel, After Me Comes a Flood, and I'm really interested in kind of allowing my imagination to land where it does, even if it creates these curious overlaps between my novels. So the house is isolated in the middle of, or on the outskirts of Audley, in this parkland that has been really left untouched in the last 100 years. And all the villagers or the townspeople of Audley, they love this park and they take their children there for picnics, and they're kept away from the house by a kind of drooping chicken wire fence. And there's rumours that there's a ghost there. So occasionally somebody will say that they see a light behind the windows, and they say that it's Maria, this vanished woman that's come back. And increasingly this house becomes a kind of locus for interactions between Thomas and James, this man that he loves. And also over the course of the 20 years of the narrative of the book, the house becomes ruined by fire and then renovated. So it goes through its own changes, but it's always a place of promise and concealment, I suppose.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Sarah Perry, and we're talking about her new novel, Enlightenment. And Sarah, before we move on to, I guess, the main woman character of the novel, I want to talk about another woman, the one you've just alluded to, who is Maria Vedova, who is the centre of the mystery. So obviously don't give away too much about it, but tell us what you can about her. She's somebody that lived at Lowland's house in the past.
Yeah. She's a woman who married the last owner of Lowland's. And it becomes evident through the discovery of her letters. Slowly, her letters and diaries and drawings are discovered through the book. And slowly, Thomas and James and Grace, the other character, come to build up a picture of a woman whose life was both illuminated and blighted by a passionate love. Not only for a man, but for the pursuit of a certain kind of science, which I won't say what it is, because it's slightly a surprise. And I had enormous fun with her because I'm very interested in the idea of hauntings and the extent to which I can allow readers to decide for themselves whether they're seeing, as it were, a real ghost or whether I'm having fun playing with them. And Thomas comes to be haunted by her, and she takes on a kind of quite embodied presence in the book. As far as I'm concerned, there's no ghost. It's Thomas's imagination. Over the course of the years, she becomes so real to him and so vivid that she sort of cohabits in his house with him, and she seems to speak to him and so on. But I'll be very interested to see whether some readers decide that actually, no, she's a real haunting, and I've kind of leaned into the Gothic.
Well, I wanted to talk about this. So just expand a little bit more on this use of Well, I have written this use of the supernatural, but the use of the imagination, we can say, in the story. Tell us something more about Thomas's relationship with Maria.
So the novel Enlightenment is you're invited to consider the possibility that Thomas himself has written this novel. So during the course of the book, he is working on a novel and he refers to it by various titles. And at one point he considers calling his novel Enlightenment. So we have this possibility that the text that you're reading is Thomas's own novel. So we know that his imagination is extremely powerful and that he's able to kind of exert a sort of control on the text. And so when we are in his point of view, we're totally embedded in Thomas's mind when he sees this ghost. And he sort of, at one point, he's got a photo of her and he sees her boots coming through the photo frame and he hears the rustling of her skirt. And she kind of leans on the edge of the table. And she's always in a temper because she's heartbroken. She's a very clever, frustrated woman. But if you look carefully, you realise that everything that she says is something that she has said in one of her letters or her diaries, or is a quotation from a poet or something. So there's nothing that the presence of Maria Vedova in the flesh, so to speak, does that couldn't also be Thomas's imagination. And the reason I wanted to do that is to play with the idea that we can be haunted in a really solid, luscious, dark, half frightening, half seductive way by our own ideas and our own memories of things. A ghost doesn't need to be a supernatural entity to be a very present presence in our life and in our house.
So Grace McCauley, then, who is the other main character of the story, when we first meet her in 1997, she's 17, she celebrates her 18th birthday in that part of the book. And you mentioned that Thomas is basically yourself, although in the body of a 50-year-old gay man. And I can't stop thinking that Grace McCauley, at 18 years old, seems to also resemble the 18-year-old Sarah Perry growing up in a strict Baptist sect.
Yes, and I think all novelists, or certainly myself, I kind of distribute portions of myself throughout all my characters and always have done, and whether that's self-regarding or generous, I don't know. But yes, Grace necessarily has many parallels with me and my upbringing, in the sense that she is raised as a strict Baptist and is conscious all of the time of the disconnect between her own upbringing in the chapel, the language that she is used to, the worship that she is used to, the clothes that she is used to wearing, the modernity of the world around her. So she doesn't understand references to pop songs or to, to television. She doesn't wear jeans and trainers the way, you know, her school friends would do. And she, like me and like Thomas, is caught between a feeling of belonging in Bethesda, belonging in the chapel, feeling perfectly content with her strange, shabby, beautiful clothes that she makes herself out of old sheets and, you know, beautiful old shawls, but also longing for whatever is beyond the chapel door. And a very good friend of mine read an opening draft, and she texted me and she said, well, at least you had the decency to make her short and dark-haired, so I'm tall and blonde. But yes, she's much of me in my youth rests in Grace, which is in fact my middle name. So,
what connection does she have to Thomas?
I was really interested in the idea of writing an intergenerational friendship. I really like writing about forms of love and forms of intimacy that are quite underwritten and viewed with a degree of suspicion. And so Thomas and Grace really are best friends, even though they're 30 years between them. And Thomas, when he was around 30, had resolved to leave the church. The shame of his sexuality, his longing to live a more flourishing life away from Audley, sort of got on top of him, and he decided he was going to leave. And on the day he was going to leave, Ronald McCauley, a church member, arrives at the church with a baby in a basket. His wife had died in childbirth, and there is now this tiny baby in the chapel, first baby to be born to the chapel in many years. And Thomas takes one look at this baby, and the baby takes one look at him, and instantly he feels a kind of mutual understanding with this infant. And he realizes that unless he stays in the church and, so to speak, keeps his foot in the door, she will never have access to the outside world or any kind of emissary from the world. So he decides, out of this sudden love for this child, that he will stay in the church and he will function as a kind of godfather to her. So they have this very, very strange, loving, but difficult friendship over the 20 years of the book. And they hurt each other terribly, but they also learn together how to navigate the world that they've been thrown into.
And what has her upbringing been like up to the point of 18?
She has been raised by her aunt, who was summoned down from her own life to help bring up this baby. They are, like most of the characters in most of my books, these are not wealthy, upper class or even middle class people. These are very, very ordinary people leading very quiet lives in small Essex houses. And she has been raised to cover her head in church, to conceal herself in the eyes of God and in the eyes of men. She's not been able to wear trousers, so she wears these long floating skirts with petticoats underneath because she loves beauty. She loves to wear very beautiful things. She's not been allowed to really attend birthday parties or to do any of the things that a teenage girl would normally do. And she's very conscious of how strange she is to other people, but other people are strange to her. So it's not a kind of straightforward oranges are not the only fruit case of, you know, religious child abuse at all. Her home is secure and there's a degree of affection from her aunt and from her very authoritarian father. But nonetheless, she starts to understand that she is living her life constantly trying to please God and to be good. And it's an overwhelming burden for a child. And as she gets older and she moves away from the church, she has to kind of navigate the world without that very fixed point of what constitutes goodness. And, you know, there are times when she decides that she's not even going to try to be good.
And so she meets a young man of around her age called Nathan. Tell us, what is it that she sees in him?
I won't spoil it, but he kind of breaks into her world. So the world of Bethesda, the world of the strict Baptist, is kind of cloistered. I think at one point Thomas conceives of it as living, like living in a village where you can see the rest of the world through a cloud, but everything seems very remote and distant. That's how Grace lives. And Nathan kind of erupts into her life by accident. And he is everything that she isn't. He is careless, gives no thought to sin and eternity and goodness. He listens to pop music on his headphones. He wears a denim jacket with brightly coloured patches sewn onto it. He is very attracted to her, but slightly repelled by her at the same time. And as you would expect, this furious, ardent 18-year-old girl falls irrevocably in love with this boy. And like Thomas and his love for James Bower, neither of them are ever able quite to let go of this connection to people who are outside of the church. And over the next 20 years, that love and the difficulties of it and the strangeness of it follows them.
And then just one more thing, and then I'll get you to read a bit. The book is about astronomy and the intersection between science and faith. And as we're friends on social media, and I know that you're mad on astronomy yourself, you're always talking about it. So I just wanted to talk about writing about astronomy and including astronomy in the novel as somebody who loves astronomy.
Oh, it was just a joy. I mean, I'm an enthusiast, you know. I'm an amateur in the truest sense of the word, that comes from Latin amat, you know, to love something. I love it more than I know about it. But I'm very lucky to have an enormous telescope, you know, a really sophisticated, large reflecting telescope that I'm able to photograph nebulas and virtually see the boot prints on the moon. It's really extraordinary. And I sort of pleased myself really in writing about it in the novel. And you're constantly aware that I'm sort of imposing my enthusiasms on my audience. But I'm hoping that wherever I've written about astronomy, I wanted it to be a little bit like the parables in scripture, you know, so that rather than them being godly little stories, Thomas writes about astronomy and we see his columns. And for him, they become ways of understanding love and mortality and responsibility and connection and intimacy. And so I'm hoping that I haven't bored people too much, and that I've kind of, that where people already have an interest in astronomy, they'll be delighted to find another enthusiast. And when they've never thought about it before, they'll be amazed by, you know, the nature of binary stars. But we'll see.
So to finish it off, can I get you to read us a bit?
Absolutely. I'm just going to read the opening couple of pages. As you said, the book is set in three parts. Each part is named after one of Kepler's laws on planetary motion. So this is part one, 1997, the law of ellipses. Monday, late winter, bad weather. The River Alder, fattened by continuous rain, went in spate through Audley and beyond it, taking carp and pike and pages torn from pornographic magazines, past war memorials and pubs and new industrial estates, down to the mouth of the Blackwater and on in due course to the sea. Toppled shopping trolleys glistened on the riverbank. So also did unwanted wedding rings and beer cans and coins struck by empires in the years of their decline. Herons paced like white-coated orderlies in the muddy reeds. And at 4:30, a fisherman caught a cup untouched since the ink was wet on the Battle of Maldon, spat twice and threw it back. Late winter, bad weather. The town oppressed by cloud as low as a coffin lid. A place spoken of in passing, if at all. Neither Boudicca nor Wat Tyler had given it a second glance when they took their vengeances to London, and war had reached it only as an afterthought when a solitary Yonkers discharged the last of its ordnance and extinguished four souls without notice. Thomas Hart was at his desk in the offices of the Essex Chronicle, surveying the town through a dissolving window. At that hour and from that vantage, lights appeared as fires set by travellers that crossed a soaking fen. Strip lights in the shoe shops and newsagents not yet shuttered for the night, and in the cinema and bowling alley opening for business 2 miles out of town. Lamplight in the bar of the Jackdaw and Crow, and street lights coming on down London Road. A man of 50, Thomas Hart, and a man of Essex for his sins, tall and retaining as much hair as he had at 40, which is to say more above the collar than the brow, dressed as has always been his habit, in clothes chosen to be admired by the observant, a jacket, single-breasted in Harris tweed, a white shirt cuffed with silver links, a tie of oatmeal knitted silk, a face he does not deceive himself is handsome, but understands to be memorable, the nose not symmetrical, but of a pleasing emphatic size, the eyes large, direct, and approaching green, an air altogether of occupying a time not his own. Might he be more at ease in an Edwardian dining room, say, or on a pitching clipper's deck? Very likely. Thomas was surveying an object on his desk. Two leather discs about the diameter of his own hand were fastened with a tarnished pin. The lower disc was painted blue and mottled with markings he couldn't have made out even if he'd been inclined to try. The blue showed through a large hole cut in the upper part, and gilded lit letters at the rim showed the months of the year and the days of the month and the hours of the day. Thomas touched it as if it carried a contagious disease. "And what," he said, "do you imagine I should do with this?"
So I've been talking to Sarah Perry. We've been talking about her new novel, Enlightenment, which is out now in the UK from Jonathan Cape. Sarah, thank you so much for taking the time to tell me about it.
Thank you, Neil.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced, presented and edited by me, Neil Denny. Little Atoms is hosted by Acast and published by 89UP. The show is broadcast on Mondays and Saturdays on Resonance 104.4 FM. Thanks for listening.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.